Well, how will our hospitals cope with an increase in COVID patients, and how quickly could they become overwhelmed? The government's year and a half pursuit of elimination was in large part to protect our health service from becoming overrun. 100 extra ICU or high dependency units have been added in the past year. But only yesterday, a survey of emergency department specialists revealed their concerns for hospitals' ability to cope with Delta patients, including preventing spread of infection from the likes of ED departments. And this echoed COVID-19 modellers who are predicting triple-figure daily case numbers in a matter of weeks and a higher number of hospitalisations. Well, the Health Minister Andrew Little last week told us work is underway to prepare the primary care and hospital system, which he says need to absorb, quote, what the virus throws at us once we relax restrictions, unquote. The Minister also told 9 to Noon work is, quote, in train to beef up ICU capacity in our hospitals. Well, Andrew Connolly is an Auckland surgeon, Associate Professor of Health and the Ministry of Health's Chief Medical Officer. Tēnā koe, Andrew, thank you very much for your time.
Good morning. Thank you, Catherine.
Could you explain, please, what your role is?
Well, the Chief Medical Officer at the Ministry role is to advise on things that need a clinical perspective and to liaise in many respects with the rest of the sector outside of the Ministry. So I spend a lot of my time liaising with district health boards and through DHBs, obviously, through to PHOs and primary care. So it's a multifaceted role, keeps me on my toes, and at the moment, obviously, a lot of it is focused on our preparations for Delta if we see increasing numbers.
But you have recent and active clinical experience. This is what is different about the role, I guess. Okay.
Yes, I'm still, I did a clinic on Friday, actually, at Middlemore, and occasionally I'm still in the operating room. Possibly at the moment, not as much as I'd like to be, but I'm still clinically active, which I think is one of the strengths of the role, is having clinically active people who do have a feel for what the front line is like. And I'm very much in awe of what my colleagues, particularly in this city, have been going through in the last 7-8 weeks, and colleagues around the country whose unrelenting desire to be as well prepared as possible just comes through every time I speak with them.
Can we work through what you can tell us about that preparation? Can we begin first with an idea, an overview of what number of daily cases and therefore associated hospitalisations, which now becomes a key metric, that you are planned for?
Yep. This all varies, of course, depending on vaccination levels. And it also depends in particular, Catherine, on the health of the unvaccinated. So if we have a population where people have decided not to be vaccinated, but their general health is very good, then the hospitalisation and the effects of the virus on that part of the community may not be as severe as we are seeing, for instance, in South Auckland, where we have a lot of people suffering from pre-existing health conditions, often living in poor housing conditions, overcrowding and so forth, where the virus has led to a higher number of people coming into hospital. So it's very important that each region studies its population in relation to its vaccination levels. And of course, the best thing any of us can do is get vaccinated. Now, in Auckland, obviously, and I'm currently in Auckland, we have the most experience of Delta, and therefore our modellers have been looking at this very closely. If, and there are a number of ifs, and we hope to avoid the worst case scenario, but our worst case scenario would see cases continue to rise and then get to a point where they begin to surge. And at that point, we know we're basically facing significant increases in cases each day until we plateau. And the plateau period is probably for 4 to 6 weeks. And that could see around 5,200, 5,300 cases per week in the northern regions. That's not just in the city, but in the northern region. Now, the vast majority of those patients, and I think this is really important for listeners to be aware of, the vast majority of those cases will not need to come into hospital. So the concern has always been that if the case numbers get too high and the numbers needing to come into hospital overwhelm us, we won't be able to care for other things such as heart attacks and cancer and broken legs and so on. At our worst, we're expecting upwards of 150 or more patients in our northern regional hospitals at any one time. However, the vast majority, as I said, will be able to be cared for in the community. Now, clearly at those numbers, we would not have everyone in an MIQ facility such as Jet Park. So a lot of our work now is directed towards preparing for self-isolation or isolation within the community, which really requires a whole of system effort from our colleagues in primary care, non-governmental organisations, Ministry of Social Development and so on, to help allow people to safely stay at home. So that's delivering them food, delivering them the medications they need, and generally speaking, virtual checkups each day to see how they're going. And this has been well proven in some jurisdictions overseas to not only reduce the pressure on our hospitals, but also, in fact, in some areas of Canada, it has been shown to improve outcomes. And that is probably because the right people go to hospital at the right time. So a huge amount of work going on in that area. And also, of course, preparing our hospitals for the influx of patients that they'll receive. And some of that is to do with processes, some of it's to do with building, and of course, staff preparedness.
Can I just check that number, that peak number of cases you anticipated? Was it 5,200? And just repeat for me, in which region?
Yeah, this is in the northern region. So this is everything really from the Bombay Hills to the top of the country. And this is what our most recent modelling suggests, a peak of around 5,200 cases in a week. And now that peak lasts for a few weeks, not necessarily at that 5,000 level, but then it starts to rapidly decrease again. And we get down to effectively a new business as usual, if you like, where we expect that there will be grumbling cases in the community each week. And that's certainly what we expect if and when borders are reopened, that we would see a small number of cases in each region potentially per week cropping up. And so we need to prepare, obviously, for the worst case scenario, which is the peak. And then, of course, we need to be ready for the new steady state, which is our normal health business, plus making COVID part of our normal health business.
You mentioned, of course, this all depends on variables such as vaccination rates and also the health of the unvaccinated, because we know the unvaccinated are going to be the most affected here. The 5,200 peak, could you tell me what presumption it makes about vaccination levels either locally or nationally?
Well, this is all on the northern region, so that is predicated on an average vaccination of 90% for our 12-year-olds and above. Now, I wasn't involved in the actual modelling, but I've spoken to the chief person who was, and they did factor in that some ethnicities may be more vaccinated than others. For instance, our Asian community is around the 95% vaccination rate now. We're delighted to see Maori and Pacific numbers growing rapidly. And of course, every day that the virus does not start to surge gives us another day to really get those numbers up. So it's predicated on an average of 90%, but there are different rates factored in for sort of estimates of where we are at the moment in terms of ethnicities.
If we use this then as our working model, you mentioned 150 or more might be in the northern regional hospitals again. So Auckland DHB hospitals, counties Manukau and Middlemore, Waitemata, North Shore, and possibly the likes of Whangarei as well, or smaller hospitals.
Correct.
In the north.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about the 150 people in hospital, because a big focus has been on ICU's capacity, including staffing. Now, a lot of the debate has been around, why haven't we increased ICU capacity more? The minister has said a large limiting factor is having the specialist nurses. He's also told us that, there's been work to skill up nurses for the particular role they might play in a COVID outbreak, even though they're not ICU trained. Could you give us an up-to-date picture of the readiness for this most acute end of need?
Yes. So again, this modelling's in some respects reassuring in that it suggests we'd have a maximum ICU occupancy of COVID at any one time of 43 COVID patients in our ICUs. And we'd average during that peak period around 34. And when we get down to the new business as usual state, if you like, after this has surged, if this surged through, we'd have an average of about 5 COVID patients across the northern region requiring ICU at any one time. Now, those numbers they're heavily intensive on the staff who have to care for those patients, but those numbers do show that we are not predicting that our ICU capacity will be overwhelmed. The big challenge around this disease, of course, is its infectiousness, and so. One of our immediate responses when we go into level 4, for instance, has been really to wind back activity that could be deferred. Now, as we go forward, we can't continue to do that because people will still need non-COVID care, particularly for major surgical procedures and so forth. And so we have already worked out approximately how many more dedicated intensive care beds and nurses we would need in the stages after any peak of COVID. And that's work that's always going on because there's population growth to factor in, as well as obviously now a new disease.
When it comes to that staffing, still frustrating for many in the profession to be reading headlines or writing headlines, contributing to headlines like the ones at the weekend, where you've got ICU staff who have jobs here and visas here and can't get a place in MIQ, or the emergency physician we spoke to yesterday who said one of their staff is in Australia and can't get back.
Yes, look, totally agree. And indeed, the minister's been very clear that this is needs to be well resolved, and I know he's working with his colleagues on that end of things. From the ministry point of view, the ministry central agency is coordinating DHB workforce and MIQ matters. There's a major meeting of all parties scheduled for later this week. It's problematic, obviously, for any New Zealander overseas. And health isn't the only area with major challenges, but when we're talking about frontline health workers, particularly our nursing and medical staff, we do want them back in the country as quickly as possible. So that work is escalating, I think, as obviously the Auckland situation has not fully resolved how we wanted it to. There's new emphasis on solving that problem.
1,400 nurses trained, we're told, to do what typically takes 5 years, which is the training of an ICU specialised nurse. But alas, they've been trained.
Take 5 years.
Okay.
So the 5-year figure, I think, does include the undergraduate nursing degree.
Right.
The 1,400 staff, the easiest way to think of this is that this is our emergency backup. They're not experienced intensive care nurses, but they are nurses who obviously understand hospitals and healthcare. And many of them, I understand, have come from areas where particularly monitoring of patients via information that comes up on screens is common. Now, that's our recovery room nurses in particular after you've had surgery. And so they're used to looking at a machine and understanding those numbers on the machine. They need to be supervised, And this is exactly the same as me being on call, say, with a very junior member of the surgical staff. They won't have the experience to make all the decisions I can make, and they certainly won't have the experience to do the operations I can do. So I need to supervise them. There will be things that they're quite capable of doing on their own. But we spoke to experts in the United Kingdom from London recently who head up intensive care units. And when all hands are to the pump, so in other words, if our usual intensive care beds and staff are insufficient for the needs, then this workforce does provide, over a brief period, which is the period of that surge and peak, a safe workforce, as long as the supervision and really the ratio of nurses that are not purely ICU to the nurse who is purely ICU is kept within a reasonable bounds. And so the UK felt quite strongly their message to us that was one experienced intensive care nurse supervising three or perhaps four surge nurses is actually a reasonable way to plan and deliver care. Now, there becomes an upper limit to that, and we don't want to reach that upper limit. We don't want to have to use the surge workforce anyway. But it's best to be prepared, which is what the DHBs have done. We're encouraging them to, of course, ensure that this training is ongoing. And hopefully some of those nurses may actually, through their training experience, see ICU as a valuable career, because we do need more pure ICU nurses anyway to adjust for the needs of all healthcare going forward.
So will those 1,400 or a substantial proportion of them be needed during that surge, 4 to 6 week surge period you have modelled, with 5,200 cases a week, 150 more in hospital? What proportion of that capacity would be needed for this example that you've modelled?
That's a very good question, Catherine. I haven't explored that in detail. Nursing ratios, the easiest way to think of this is it takes a little over five nurses per intensive care bed per day to keep that bed open 365 days a year. So at the moment, the northern region has opened today more intensive care unit beds than the predicted maximum during the peak year, that we've had a prediction of 43. Now, what we may need additional the use of the surge workforce for is to assist non-COVID care to be done, because we obviously need to carry on with some of that, or as much as possible. Now, it would involve quite a discussion with the intensive care nursing and rostering people for me to be able to formally answer your question. But at those levels of maximum COVID that we're expecting in our ICUs in this region, we would not exceed the current bed numbers available.
So the bed numbers, I understand the extra 100 brings the ICU beds themselves to 340. It can surge up to 500, I understand, ICU high dependency unit level beds. And the other question then is the ventilators. Again, looking at the modelling you've done, what's the capacity with the ventilators that we have now?
Well, we have a bit over 700, apparently over 700 intensive care capable ventilators. There are differences between a ventilator in an operating room and a ventilator in an ICU, but I gather we have upwards of 700. Now, not everyone in intensive care is on a ventilator. In fact, in normal times, it's the minority of patients are on a ventilator at any one time. And as patients either are deteriorating or improving, the ventilator often fits the middle of that period. So you may be deteriorating and need to go onto a ventilator, then unlike most TV shows, you don't instantly come off the ventilator, start talking and go up to the ward. So there's sort of a period at either end. You know, theoretically, we can just keep adding people to ventilators until we've used every ventilator we have. These numbers suggest that is absolutely not going to be required. but it's wise that we have the redundancy in the system. You know, the vast majority of people are not going to end up in hospital, and are not, and those who do, the vast majority are not going to end up in intensive care. But the best way to maximise all our chances of getting any health care that we all need, strokes, heart attacks, broken legs, cancer surgery, is to be vaccinated, because that absolutely changes the game. It is vanishingly rare to end up in intensive care if you are fully vaccinated. And in fact, to date, I think it's only 3 fully vaccinated patients have ended up needing any hospital care. So the vaccine absolutely changes everything.
And the modelling you've done is based on that 90% average, which we are still striving for, but we are in this very awkward interregnum where there are fears remaining, an outbreak could spiral. On that point, infection spreading, we heard yesterday again from our emergency department specialist as well, concerned about things like EDs. The curtains aren't really going to cut it in this situation, right? Concerned that there's some negative pressure rooms in some parts of the hospital system around the country, perhaps not enough. There's variation between large and small hospitals. And the other point he made was there are some manual units, it seems to be, I can't recall their name, that could also perhaps do a similar job. And the final point he raised was things like the rapid antigen testing, so that when people appear at a hospital, you can find out quickly whether they are high or low risk of being infectious. This all makes a lot of sense. There's infections at Middlemore, and there's staff who've been impacted. What plan were we to have an outbreak, a nasty outbreak in the interregnum? What plan to boost infection control?
Well, infection control actually is very good. So, look, we've heard the government announce yesterday, and I'm delighted with the announcement, mandatory vaccination. We already have an extremely high vaccinated workforce, but until the concern about some staff, I think, in the dialysis unit at Waitemata came up in the weekend, we've had zero cases of transmission or infection of a healthcare worker in any of our hospitals, nor had any COVID negative patients caught COVID within our hospitals. So with very good vaccination rates, soon to be 100%, excellent PPE, very good training in that PPE, and very good processes, we have shown that we can be as safe as possible. Now, the rapid antigen testing is being trialed at Middlemore. I understand it has detected cases who appeared to have no symptoms or on their screening questionnaire no risks. So I think we will see things such as rapid testing become part of our armamentarium. There's massive technological developments going on this all the time. The other thing that's very interesting, we had the announcement from Pharmac yesterday about an early agreement for a drug that, if given within the first 4 or 5 days, appears to, in trials overseas, dramatically reduce the need to come to hospital. We do know that, again, the evidence from our county's respiratory colleagues during this outbreak is that aggressive and appropriate oxygen management is reducing the number of people who need to go to the ICU. We know that home monitoring has been shown to reduce the number of people who need to come to hospital. So there's a lot being done. Negative pressure rooms are really interesting. Negative pressure rooms do not make it any safer for the people within that room. What a negative pressure room does is improves the safety of the environment outside the room by keeping the bugs in the room. So effectively, it increases our available real estate. So it is possible to consider more beds in our hospitals being available for non-COVID patients if we have all of the COVID in negative pressure rooms. So that's why there's a strong desire to have the negative pressure capability. It's best summed up as highly desirable but not essential. So just to reiterate, it does not make it safer for the staff in those rooms. that helps outside the room.
One of the benefits of the survey we covered yesterday, the emergency room survey, is that you get a variety of perspectives from the front lines from around the country. And they had a reasonable return rate. It was over a third for very, very busy people and from every DHB. And again, on some of these matters, you hear the variations. Yep, still waiting for our N95 mask fit. Or other variations as well. And I'm curious as to what the plan is if there are outbreaks outside of the northern region. We know the focus is there for very, very obvious reasons, biggest area and also most affected area at the moment. But are we going to see plans where perhaps were there a serious outbreak in some districts, patients might be moved to hospitals with better facilities and staffing? What's the more national plan?
Good question, Catherine. So there's a lot of work going on that national plan. Of course, other centres have all been putting their plans together right since the start of all of this back last year because of there's been MIQ facilities, et cetera, in various towns. We've actually just, some of my colleagues at the Ministry have just finished an initial review of all the DHB surge plans, if you like, from around the country. That's identified DHBs are well prepared. Things like fit testing, the vast majority of frontline hospital staff have had fit testing. This is a test to know that you're putting your mask on correctly. Fair to say that there's a lot of work still to do in some parts of the country with our community and primary care colleagues. The ministry is actually, DHBs and PHOs were broadly in charge of that, but the ministry has actually bought more machines to assist with that. Now, just being fit tested does not mean you always put your mask on correctly. So there is a, every time you put a N95 mask on, you've got to do what's called a fit check. I had to do this on Friday for the first time in quite some time. And in fact, it took me several goes to get my mask and my nose to align correctly because I kept fogging up my glasses. So I knew it wasn't fitting properly. So we've done a lot of education on that front. In terms of flow of patients, there's two aspects to this. One is what to do with COVID patients, particularly those who are deteriorating and needing intensive care. And the intensive care network, who are superb to work with, I must say, are doing a lot of work to really confirm what is the best thing to do with patients. Now, that might be that some are moved from some small units into their major regional centre. But one of the problems with this disease is that some people become very sick very fast and are not safe to transfer. And so we do need to make sure that each hospital is capable of keeping a small number of COVID cases if they had to. In terms of ward-based care, it's a case of making sure that best practice and particularly the learnings from our three Auckland hospitals are shared with those colleagues. On the primary care working group, we're very fortunate to have a respiratory expert who is employed by a major DHB but spends most of his career looking at respiratory disease in the community. So that's addressing that interface between community and secondary. And we mustn't forget, of course, the other end of the spectrum, which is when people go home if they've been admitted with COVID. We do know that this the fatigue and the long COVID-type symptoms may last a long time. So we need to be prepared to help people at that end too.
Professor Connolly, one final question. We've talked about the northern districts in particular, so Auckland North, and we've done a lot of our discussion based on that and the average 90% vaccination rate based on that. I think Auckland's around 85, 86% first dose at the moment. Nationally, it's 82%. Nationally, 56, 57% around second dose. We're a ways off. And what is your final message on this race and how much we need to pick up the pace?
Every single vaccinated person in this country is helping not only themselves, not only their family, they're helping their neighbours, the rest of their community. They're helping those who can't be vaccinated, which are our youngest. They're helping our most frail. I just implore everyone. I appreciate some people hold genuine concerns. I would just ask that they seek information really from somewhere other than Facebook or various internet sites that are promoting, that are spreading information that is just not credible. Please talk to someone who's had the vaccine. Please talk to a trusted health advisor. This is as the Prime Minister said on the first day back last year when we went into level four, it's a team of 5 million. We really need as many of the 5 million as possible to be vaccinated. It is by far the best thing we can do. It is really the only way to secure our future. So I just implore people to be vaccinated. Those who aren't vaccinated will catch this disease. It will seek them out. And that's disastrous.
We've also discussed a system that is holding and functioning at 90% double dosed averaged in that region. We haven't discussed what happens if we have a major outbreak before we get there. And suffice to say, that is a system struggling to cope and people under immense pressure.
Yes, it is. So we know that a single dose adds some protection, but there's still been quite a number of single dose people requiring admission. Those figures that we've discussed this morning, Catherine, will significantly change at a single dose. We must all get double dosed. It is safe. It's highly effective. And we are very fortunate that whilst we have three regions of concern in the country, we have an opportunity we must not blow. This virus gives very few opportunities. It hardly ever gives a second chance.
That is Andrew Connolly. He is an Auckland surgeon, associate professor of health and chief medical officer at the Ministry of Health.